Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
And may it please the Court, my name is Mike Hazard, and with me at the council table is Chris Vandenberg. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. CORE filed this forbearance petition from Section 251G because under that section, the FCC maintains rules that preserve inflated access charges for incumbents and below-cost rates for competitors like CORE. Under 251G, for example, Verizon charges CORE about 8 times more for terminating CORE's voice-over internet protocol.
Didn't we say in WorldCom that 251G can't support this?
Yes, Your Honor. WorldCom was found to not be able to support this, but WorldCom was remanded without vacatur.
I'm asking you a standing question.
Yes, Your Honor, but WorldCom, in WorldCom, it addressed traffic going inbound to CORE and not traffic going outbound.
No, but didn't WorldCom say that 251G can't support the interim rules, period? Sent it back to see if there was some other basis for it, right?
The interim rules at issue in WorldCom are not the interim are not the rules that cause CORE to pay Verizon more money when CORE sends Verizon traffic than when it receives traffic. But I would also add that those.
Sorry, I thought you relied on the ISP remand order.
Right.
As the regulations that were doing you harm.
The ISP, there's a little bit of confusion here because what effectively happens or what happens has happened under the Act is in 1996 Congress set forth a provision called 251B5, which on its face applies to all telecommunications. Over the past decade, through a variety of means, the FCC has excised traffic through this transitional means on a temporary basis. So 251B5 has become a very, very small category. And 251G has become this very, very large basket of traffic that actually has sub-baskets in it. The information access basket, which the basket under which the FCC put ISP-bound traffic to CORE from folks like Verizon and other incumbent LECs, traffic going from CORE to Verizon and others is under a different basket under 251G called the exchange access basket. And under that basket, CORE has to pay these above-cost access charges. But all of these rules and all of these regulations are promulgated pursuant to this what was called a transitional carve-out.
When you get to the standing issue, which is only in your reply brief, the key passage seems to be pages 4 to 6, which talk about the ISP remand order. If there are other commission regulations that you rely on as inflicting injury, what are they?
They are the preserved exchange access regime that's been...
Where do you talk about that?
If we look at on 4, CORE's forbearance petition addresses its other offerings and regulation. If I could just go to the top, please. Although CORE has concentrated the last 7 years of its advocacy before this court and the commission on issues associated with the unresolved ISP remand order in this court's mandate in WorldCom, which the remand is pending, CORE's forbearance petition addresses its other offerings and regulation utilized by incumbent local exchange carriers to bill CORE more money for traffic exchange than CORE can bill the ILECs, even though the FCC has found that the functionality for the exact same service provided by CORE and the ILECs is indistinguishable.
Okay, but you do not cite any regulation.
We cite the statutory provision 251G, which was in our petition.
Nor do you say what the, quote, other offerings are, close quote.
The other offerings are outbound service. There's no magic name for it. It's just the ability of our customers to place calls to the other carriers, such as Verizon or other incumbent local exchange carriers.
We wouldn't know any of this from just your opening brief, though, would we?
I believe that my opening brief. Well, let me back up. A number of questions were raised below about whether CORE's petition was proper under Section 160. The FCC ultimately declined to reach that question, and instead it went through and it provided its order. Now, we were aggrieved by the FCC's order in two ways. One, it was promulgated after the one-year deadline, and in our view, it was deemed granted by operational law.
No, that can't give you standing.
Well, it would
assume the worst.
Right.
Standing.
I understand, Judge Williams. And if I may go through it, please. So the second part, our petition was deemed granted. We didn't get the benefit of the deemed grant. And then the second thing is on the merits, it was denied. So we were aggrieved by the denial of our petition, which is a statutory standing issue.
You haven't identified a real world interest that you have.
I believe we have, and I can point to a record site.
You pointed very explicitly to the ISP remand order, and I think the panel clearly understands what's involved in the ISP remand order. Then you allude vaguely to other regulations and other traffic, none of which is revealed.
And the traffic is our outbound traffic, our voice over internet protocol offerings.
And assuming that's something discrete that we can get our hands on,
yes.
We don't know what regulation purports to govern it, or you see as governing it.
The exchange access regulations apply to it, and we've referenced that in other places in the brief, and what we have said is that when we send traffic to the others, we are billed rates that are, in some instances, eight times as much as we're able to collect. In other instances, AT&T put evidence in the record that these rates can be, up to 35 cents a minute for traffic termination, which is 500 times what we're able to collect for providing what the FCC has found is the exact same functionality. And sincerely, Your Honors, I am not on the standing front. We send traffic to them. We get charged these exorbitant access charge rates. We're denied our ability to pay under 251B5, which is what Congress prescribed. And on the other hand, we're precluded from collecting under Section 251B5, which is also what Congress prescribed. And that's what it comes down to. And if you'd like me, I can point to other parts in the record where we reference our outbound traffic offerings.
So your view then is that under our rules, your standing was self-evident, and you didn't need to say anything in your opening brief about it?
We have a statement on standing in our opening brief.
I mean, I'm asking about our specific rule. Our rule is that
if your
standing is not self-evident, you have to document and prove your standing in the opening brief, the reply brief.
Yes, sir. As I understand,
so your
the
position must be that it's self-evident.
Well, it's twofold. One, I believe it is self-evident because CORE was the petitioner and CORE's petition was denied.
Yeah, but that doesn't give you standing. That doesn't give you Article III standing.
Well, to under 402, we get to seek review of FCC orders. But in any
only
event,
if you're
we
injured by them.
And we are injured by it. And we went through it in our initial brief. As I have read the cases regarding this circuit's rules, they largely involve associational standing. And that's to make sure at least one member of the association.
I'm sorry, is there something in our rules that limits the requirement for advance briefing or opening brief briefing of standing to associational standing?
No, Judge Williams, your rules do not mention that. I was referring to the case law I'm most familiar with that implicates those rules.
What's other case law?
I don't doubt that there is. But where I've seen it come up most common is in the associational standing context.
No, but is there a case that says our rules apply only in the associational, or are you talking about cases where this rule is invoked in an associate where the petitioner is an association?
The latter, Your Honor.
Yeah, there's no case that says. We've never said that our rules are limited to associational standing.
No, Your Honor, but my only suggestion, it's the most common flavor that I've experienced in reviewing cases by this court. But again, we did have a section in our brief on standing. I know that it's been called, perhaps cursory by some. But again, all these issues were raised below, and below we talked about our outbound service offerings as well as our inbound service offerings. And the FCC passed on those issues in its order. So I believe it was reasonable for us to believe that our standing, at least vis-a-vis this court, would be self-evident. But even that being the case, we went ahead and contained or put in our opening brief a standing section.
But again, about Section 254G?
254G? It's similar. What we're really faced with is kind of the twin pillars of 251G and 254G.
254G applies to rules for
inter-exchange traffic.
Exchange traffic, right?
Yes. When we send our VoIP traffic.
How would we know from your opening brief that CORE is in that business?
I believe we described the effect of 254G. And I apologize for not having the page right here.
Generally describe it on pages
7
and 8.
And on page 18, Your Honor. And again, what we indicated was that CORE remains subject to disparate intercarrier compensation regimes preserved by 251G, even though the FCC has found that there is no economic or technical basis for preserving different rates for identical functionalities. And ongoing application of 254G's rate averaging and integration rules, which preclude CORE from utilizing differentiated pricing for long distance services, and further chills CORE's entry into rural market areas where incumbents receive implicit subsidies through this provision.
Sentence says that you are engaged in long distance.
Yeah, so we send traffic to the incumbents that get billed at long distance rates, and under the FCC's rate averaging and integration rule, we're precluded from passing those rates on to our end user customers.
At page 18, certainly, you don't explain why incumbents receive implicit subsidies, but you would not. Right.
Well, we explain what the effort was to explain is that when we send traffic to the incumbents, we pay the 251G exchange access charge rates. When we receive traffic from the incumbent.
But your issue there depends on the ISP remand order.
Well, insofar as the rate we're entitled to receive is below cost, so it would be impossible for us.
It's dependent upon the ISP remand order.
Well, the FCC's
That's
ongoing
what you say is keeping your rates below cost.
Well, the FCC's ongoing preservation of those regulations, and if you look at our forbearance petition, Judge Williams,
it seemed to come back again and again to the ISP remand order.
And the regulations preserved under the ISP remand order continue to be in force against CORE. And what we said in our
Then let me try to see if I can fit the passage of page 18 into the rest of it. You're saying that the incumbents receive implicit subsidies because their business is less heavily impacted by the ISP remand order. Is that it?
Well, it's not impacted at all, Your Honor, because it's...
Not at all, then.
It's put into a separate regulatory basket, this exchange access basket.
So, again, we come back to the ISP remand order.
Well, the ISP remand order, as this Court has noted in other instances, has a mirroring rule that in some sense can take the edge off of the disparity between rates, but the mirroring rule doesn't apply to exchange access traffic. So again, we're forced to pay these far above 251B5 rates at the same time we collect far below rates. And if I may just note that in our petition, we were careful in the way we drafted it. We said forbearance from 251G rate regulation and regulations promulgated pursuant to 251G. And so by virtue of
whatever the history of the ISP remand order, today it isn't pursuant to 251G.
Well, Your Honor, in 2003 we filed a forbearance petition specifically on the ISP remand order, and the FCC granted forbearance from two of four of the regulations promulgated under 251G.
Wasn't that before WorldCom?
No, that was after WorldCom, Your Honor. WorldCom came out in 2002. We filed our petition in July of 2003, and it was resolved in 2004 and came up to this court in CORE Forbearance 1 in 2006. It was resolved.
I'm sorry. There, you specifically targeted particular provisions of the ISP remand order.
We articulated particular provisions of the ISP remand order. But here we talked about the Exchange Act. Really what we talked about was all rate regulation for telecommunications traffic exchange carved out of 251B5. And our view is that if you forbear from this archaic 13-year-old exception, you're left with Congress's rule, which is 251B5, which is the natural reading of the statute. The 251B5 applies to all telecommunications traffic. And that, you know, the State Commission set the rate for that traffic under 252D2. And this has been an ongoing issue. We've had the Commission attempting to avoid Section 251B5 and the application of that through 251B5. That's what Bell Atlantic's about. That's what WorldCom's about. And that's what the pending mandamus is about. And I see that in spite of reserving rebuttal time, I didn't get very far in my argument.
All right. Let's hear from respondent, and then we'll give you a minute or two.
Good morning. I'm Nandan Joshi for the FCC. Let me start with the standing argument. As this court knows, Article 3 and this court's rules require a petitioner to make a standing showing that's particularized and concrete by their opening brief. We do not think they've met their burden here for the reasons we've set out. And we are, I think, we were just as confused as to what CORE's interest here is. In terms of exactly what it is, how it thinks forbearance from 251G and 254G would benefit its operations. I will mention one point as to 254G. Before the Commission, CORE argued that the reason 254G hurt its businesses is that it prevented it from deploying new services. That's the May 18th ex parte letter, which is at Joint Appendix page 199. Now, that suggests to us, at least in terms of the record that was before the Commission, that CORE did not offer long-distance services that were currently subject to Section 254G.
Well, if it was on the brink, or at least developing a business plan for going into that sort of activity, would there not be standing if 254G and regulations thereunder made that less profitable than it otherwise would be?
I think if they had made that showing under Lujan and Alaska Legislative Council, if they showed they had concrete plans to enter the long-distance market in a manner that would subject them to 254G, that would be sufficient.
Could I take it be tentative plans, right? I mean,
Something more than the statement that it prevents them from deploying new services.
Breach, no matter what the law says. And in the hopes that the law will be found illegal, right, the regulations.
Well, I think that there has to be something more than a tentative aspiration to enter the long-distance market. And recall that 254G only applies to a carrier that offers service in both either urban and rural areas or in across state boundaries. Now, if CORE is only offering long-distance services in urban areas, I'm not sure that it would even be subject to Section 254G.
It only it's firm by firm.
No, it's marked.
The firm has to be in both urban, rural, or both multi-state.
Well, the effect of 254G is to require uniform rates across markets, especially high-cost and low-cost markets. So, if a company is only offering service in a low-cost market, only urban areas, I'm not not across state boundaries. I'm not sure how it would be affected by 254G. Once again, though, the main point here is that CORE simply hasn't explained any of this, in either in its filings before the Commission or by its opening brief in this court.
I have just an economic question that's puzzled me about this. Under these averaging rules, the rates in the benefited areas are kept, we're told, below cost, because cost is the overall governing principle. So if there's this averaging, they must be below cost in the favored areas. Why do people enter those markets?
You're,
I mean firms, of course.
I don't have an explanation for that, Your Honor. They do. Obviously, we have servers throughout the country. I'm not sure of the economics behind that. And what if we get to the merits of 254G, CORE doesn't explain the economics behind that or how its forbearance petition would, you know, change the world in terms of firms entering the market or the effect of customers in the benefited areas. You did not get to any questions on the merits of this, of CORE's argument in the opening with Mr. Hazard, and I think our brief is fairly straightforward. I'm happy to address any issue with regard to the merits, either the deemed grant or argument or the merits of the commissions for merit.
On their opening brief on page 18.
Yes, Your Honor.
At the top of the page there, where CORE sets out its standing argument, at least the last part of it. I mean, there, if you read it, don't you think that's reasonably read as saying they do offer this long-distance service?
Well, it says they are, let's see, it says they remain subject to the ongoing application of such Section 254G's rate averaging and integration rules. Now, once again, before the commission that...
CORE from utilizing differentiated pricing. So you're saying it's not clear.
Well, that could be read to mean if they at some point in the future enter the long distance market.
So now in the reply brief, they send us to their website.
They do.
All right. Yes, they do. So I went to the website, and it shows that they have tariffs from you and a couple of states.
Well, I think only Pennsylvania, if I recall the web.
I thought that was Maryland, too. Any rate. So that's not enough either?
Well, I'm not sure it is. Once again, I think there are some state commissions that require a carrier to offer intrastate long-distance services. So they might have a tariff but not really offer service. The other possibility is, once again, they might offer service only the low-cost areas, so they're not really subject to 254G in any event.
When I clicked on the tariffs, they didn't tell me what service. They simply said what the rules were. You understand what I mean, the difference. So is your basic point is that the commission doesn't know what services CORE offers?
Well, we know they are a receiver of ISP-bound traffic. Right. They have a history of that.
That's all you know.
That's all we've had a history of dealing with them is with respect to that issue.
Can I go back to your original point that if they're only offering service in either rural or urban or one state, then they're not subject to the averaging rules. Let's assume that's true as a matter of law. But if the prices are being held down in the preferred areas, and I'm going to assume with you that legally they can charge whatever they like, at least in the sense of not being limited by these rules, they won't get any business though, right? Because everyone else, all their competitors, will be selling below their prices.
Well, I think in the urban areas, if their competitors are offering nationwide long distance, they're selling above price in the urban areas to compensate for the.
But I don't understand CORE to be complaining about price limits that are above cost, right? They're complaining about price limits below cost, right? Maybe they're complaining about the other. That would be an interesting argument. But I think they're complaining about things that limit them to prices below cost. You say no problem because if they're only one of the types of areas, the rules don't apply. I'm assuming arguendo that's true. They still have to compete with the people, firms who are in there selling below cost.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but I don't think you'll find any argument to that effect in their opening.
I'm trying to figure out what they're meaning.
I really don't have much to say about that. I think their standing argument's a little bit like a Rorschach test. You can see into it what you want, but I just don't see that it meets this court's standard for demonstrating standing by the opening brief. That's reflected in this court's rule. So once again, unless this court has any other questions, I'll be happy to rest on our briefs with respect to the merits of CORE's arguments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
in Your Honor, at a minimum, and just from quickly going through the record, at Joint Appendix page 219, we noted in response to some of the standing arguments made by other commenters, but not adopted by the Commission, that CORE is injured by the application of disparate intercarrier compensation systems, which have the effect of harming CORE. When CORE sends traffic to ILEX, ILEX charge non-cost-based access charges regulated under Section 251G. And then on the other page, when ILEX send traffic to CORE, the ILEX pay CORE much lower rates than under Section 251B5 or under the ISP remand order. And actually, when I checked with CORE in preparing for the argument, they said right now they are unable to charge any traffic at the 251B5 rate because they can't separate it out. It just all gets kind of dumped into the ISP basket, and it's just the virtue of the new technology that you can't kind of on a call-by-call basis identify whether it's a voice.
It is, again, the ISP remand order that is your problem.
There's no doubt that the ISP remand order keeps our rates below cost, but what the rates that we have to pay going up on the above cost rates, the rates that no one questions are over the 251B5 rates for telecommunications provided in the Act, that no one disputes that those are above cost, and no one disputes that when we send traffic to the ILEX, like Verizon, that we have to pay those above cost rates. And just to make one note on, Judge Williams, your question about the rural areas, if you look at a state like Pennsylvania, where CORE will provide both interstate and intrastate long distance, the FCC has de-tariffed interstate long distance, so it's not really a big regulatory issue. But in a state like Pennsylvania, where CORE has facilities in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Wilkes-Barre, and like Altoona, there are a large number of rural carriers in that state, all of whom have wildly ranging access charges, all of whom charge CORE those rates. And then CORE, under the rate averaging and integration rules, can't pass those on to its customers. And the same is true for callers that might make calls in farther-flung regions or from Baltimore to Harrisburg or Baltimore to Altoona. Are there any other questions on standing? But to get to redressability, were the Commission to forbear from 251G? And all of the categories in 254G are telecommunications. There's no dispute about that. The general rule of 251B5 would apply. All the rates would be harmonized, and CORE's injury would be eliminated. And in fact, CORE would then just in forbearance from the 254G rate averaging and integration.
But again, you're wrapping the ISP remand order into 251G.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, that's in part of where we sit, that the ISP remand order, I mean, we have tried mightily to get the FCC to resolve that, and the court has been of great assistance recently, and we appreciate that. But the fact of the matter is 251G contains a whole host of regulations over and above the ISP remand order, and what we're trying to do is get to 251B5, which, again, that was Congress's choice of reciprocal compensation for all telecommunications. And Congress took that rate-making authority outside of the FCC's authority and put it into the state commissions. But the FCC hasn't been satisfied with that. And what the FCC has wanted to do is prescribe these rates and regulate these rates. And the result have been the preservation of extremely high rates for incumbents and extremely low rates for companies like CORE. And that's ultimately the redressability that would recur if all the rates would go into 251B5. And I'm well beyond my time at this point.
All right. We will take the case under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Stand, please.